Hey, it's Bill Simmons. Did you know I've had my podcast for 15 years? Do you know that it is the most downloaded sports podcast of all time? Did you know I have guests from the sports world, from the culture world, people who work for The Ringer, people outside The Ringer, celebrities, experts, you name it. It's on my podcast 3 times a week, late Sunday night, late Tuesday night, late Thursday night, the Bill Simmons podcast. Check it out on Spotify.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I need sports to have to clear the room.
Stand up and walk now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, making beef three ways, it's Andy Greenwald!
I really am ready. I mean, I'm ready for the era, and Chris is making a Top Chef reference. Sorry, I always get away from that. But I'm ready for the era for rappers other than Action Bronson to do elaborate food-based metaphors, because Beef Three Ways is a great mixtape posse cut.
I don't know why there isn't a Conway mixtape called Beef Three Ways.
Probably because he's inevitable.
Yeah. Andy, special show today. So obviously, as we've alluded to, we'll talk a little bit about the first episode of Top Chef season 19 set in Houston. I also have an interview in the second half of this show with none other than Nikolai Coster-Waldau, who people probably know as Jaime Lannister from Game of Thrones, which was a major subject of this podcast for nigh on 6 years or 7 years or whatever it was. I'll just say that Nikolai has a movie on Netflix this week that's very cool called Against the Ice. That's why I was talking to him. It's a two-hander with him and Joe Cole, who people may know from Peaky Blinders and Gangs of London. And it's basically it's a true story set in the early 20th century about Danish explorers who were trying to prove that Greenland was in fact one landmass. Mm-hmm. And don't let that scare you, because it's basically a frozen tundra adventure. And Nikolai's amazing. And the reason why I wanted to talk to him was I just think that it's been really cool watching him sort of plot his career since Game of Thrones, because he's chosen to do a bunch of really interesting small genre pictures like Shot Caller and Small Crimes and A Taste of Hunger and now Against the Ice. And he co-wrote Against the Ice. And I just thought he was just an interesting cat. I just really wanted to talk to him. And let me tell you, he was also a beautiful man. So just he's still got that going for him. So stay tuned for the second half of the episode, my chat with Nikolai.
Was he like, oh my God, Talk the Thrones. I love you guys.
He didn't mention that. I wanted to ask him a lot of, you know what, one thing that I didn't do two things. One, I wanted to ask him about his Leeds United fandom. Didn't do that. Oh, okay. I mentioned at the beginning before we started the interview, and he was just like, yeah. The second thing is that he has
sounds great, by the way.
He has a sick welcome to my home tour on Architectural Digest's YouTube channel.
Oh, that's good stuff.
And he's just like wearing striped linen pants and no shoes. And he's just like, welcome to my LA home. These are these plates that I got in Lima. You know, like it's just like awesome. But when you see, if you ever want to ask, I feel like that would be weird to ask somebody like, oh, I saw the kind of plates you have in your kitchen. Because they, even though they open up their doors to Architectural Digest, I still feel like there's like a barrier where you're like, don't fucking talk about my plates, man. I'm Jaime Lannister. Listen, your hand off.
This is fascinating to me, because honestly, I think there is nothing more interesting and revealing than a splashy photo set of someone's home and in most intimate places. I also think there's nothing more psychotic than allowing anyone to do that. And I feel fascinated and mortified at the same time. Like, I agree. I would love to see people's homes, and then I would never mention it to them because I can't believe they did that. Like, I would barely let you in my home, and you're my best friend. Like, it's just bizarre.
Much less root around and look at your ceramics and your textiles.
Well, first of all, that's because they're extremely valuable. I went big on ceramic and textiles. You know, like when other people were investing in Gazprom, not me. I believe in ceramic.
I just wish I had the opportunity to do something like that when I was in my early 20s. And I was just like, welcome to my one bedroom or studio apartment, Architectural Digest. In the fridge, you'll find one half eaten box of raspberry Danish from Entenmann's. And on the wall, a painting I found on trash day.
Oh my God. No, like here is my Brooklyn apartment circa 2002. Ladies and gentlemen, if you may notice, this is the New York Times in a blue plastic bag on the floor. That's Mondays. Here's Tuesdays in a plastic bag on the floor. Don't touch the one over there. That's last Wednesdays in a plastic bag on the floor.
You make it sound like you're Kevin Spacey in Seven.
I mean, wasn't I? Like it was a different time. Chris, what would you, if you were forced to, right? Like you open your door to your home in Los Angeles and there's a camera crew. And they're like, we're coming in one way or another. Like, what
am
is
I on
your
cops?
Right. While your wife is flushing your ceramics and textiles, what?
That was all we had.
What would you show them? Like, what would
Phoebe,
you be
those
like?
Those plates were all we had.
How could you do that, Phoebe? What? Is there something that is like, oh, this is an item I'm proud of? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't have a...
Yeah, I do. I do. We have a couple of artisan crafts that I personally think are lovely. Some stained glass. My wife's super into stained glass, so we have, like, a couple of stained glass ornaments. Really? And, you know, it's weird. She has a very cool couple of framed covers of various editions of The Master and Margarita, which I understand might be a little out of fashion right now, but the Bulgakov novel. But for instance, like, I think we have some cool stuff. I'd be like, check this out. We got that at Foyles in London. You know, I think I'd be able to put on a little bit of show. And then I'd be like, you know, here are the blackout curtains because the sun is always out here, you know?
Should we pivot to our subject matter?
I want to talk about Russian literature?
Chris, I always want to talk about Russian literature. Are you crazy? Like, I would, you know, but does our audience?
Okay, so I actually have a segue for this. So before we get into Top Chef, I did want to talk to you about a trailer that came out this week for a show called Slow Horses on Apple TV. This is one of me and Andy's most anticipated shows of the year. It stars Gary Oldman, who heads up a department of MI5 called Slough House. It's basically like where they send loser spies to while out the rest of their days. It's a great conceit for a spy show. It's also it's adapted from a series of novels by a really great writer named Mick Herron, who's written a series of books. The show is called Slow Horses, which is a kind of twist on the Slough House name. It's what they call the spies who are there. And he's written, I think, 8 books in this series. The show itself comes from, I believe it's created by or run by Will Smith, who's done work on Veep and a bunch of other great stuff. And it looks like it has a really cool combination of comedy, espionage, action, drama. It looks dope. Great cast. Kristen Scott Thomas is in it. But there's an interesting thing that I want to see how people react to it because, first of all, Andy, do you want to just say what you thought of the trailer?
I just want to say that I think that we should have a category, and I know that historically we don't do well with having like segments or categories in this podcast, but I feel like there's a certain type of project that is just going to be like the Colonel James category. You remember the character in Boogie Nights who's just very clear about the things that he likes, which involve, you know, the proper placement of butter and lollipops. And this is how I feel about the show. This is a Colonel James show. We are going to watch this show. I watched this trailer and I was like, this is everything I like. It's everything I like. And I can't wait to watch it. And I don't have any nuance. I don't have a take. I don't have like a particular point of view that how it's going to do in the marketplace. I'm just thrilled that it exists. And Oldman looks like he's having a blast.
So I do have one thing I want to bounce off you about this.
Yeah.
The novel came out in 2010. And to give people a sense of, you know, how different the world was, both in terms of, you know, geopolitics, but the way the world of espionage was depicted in mm-hmm. in media. That's also right before I think Homeland came out in 2011. Started in 2011.
It did. Yeah, first year at Grantland.
So that's like it's a useful way of thinking about what was on at the forefront of people's minds in terms of those kinds of stories back then. And I would say, at least in my experience from reading Slow Horses, the novel, it covers similar ground. A lot of stuff about terrorism, a lot of stuff about domestic responses to terrorism is in the novel. And I think it's going to be in the show. And I kind of like saw my life flash before my eyes, thinking about like how much the world's sort of changed since 2011. And in some ways hasn't, but in a lot of ways, like, the kinds of stories that you would, how you would tell stories differently, the amount of technological innovations that have taken place, the nuances of how, what we understand about the world stage and maybe some nuances about how we don't understand the world stage. And even in, you know, in the last couple of years, like maybe even the way the chessboard has changed in terms of like who we regard as the West's emissaries, which for the sake of storytelling purposes tends to be, you know, when we're talking about these kinds of spy shows, there tends to be an antagonist on the other end of the board. And it's just changed so much since this novel was written. I don't know if the show is set in 2010, if they were going to do all the novels as seasons of this show. I suppose they could go through the years. The most recent Slow Horses book, I think, came out last year or this year. It's in hardcover, so it's recent. I don't know. I thought it was like an interesting element of adapting the recent fiction.
I think it's potentially fascinating to see what decision they make. I would come down though on the side of, for me, it doesn't matter. And I think it can get delicate and it can get a little precious when you are trying to, you know, hit your moment in terms of telling a story that is ripped from the headlines. Shout out to Law and Order. Like, I think you're going to trip yourselves up. The thing that was so appealing to me about this trailer, and I have not read the book, was just, It just seemed to swagger off the screen with an understanding of what it is in terms of tone, in terms of world, who these characters are, what their station is, both in relationship to the larger spy apparatus and also to each other. I was thrilled by that. And I don't look to this stuff for journalism. And one interesting thing for us in terms of our spy fandom was, you know, I hope many people listening went along with us on the journey to the French show Le Bureau, which is like the greatest spy show on TV and one of the greatest pieces of spy fiction of this century. Even that, and we watched it late, like we got into it around the time we were potting about it. So last year, a year and a half ago, the show began in 2015. The show was itself late and was always playing catch up in a way that was kind of interesting to world events, to the point where by the time the series was wrapping up, Russia was becoming a much bigger player. Cyber stuff, or cyber, as they said, was becoming a much bigger part of it. Yeah. And then when we spoke to Eric Rochant, the creator, he was like, oh, you know, I really feel like everything I do from now on has to be about China. And he operates that way. You know, he is inspired from things that are ripped from the headlines, and that fuels his drama. But
newsflash, Eric, you had it right the first time.
Exactly. Like, first draft, sometimes first thought, best thought. But all of this is to say, like, what's compelling to us about spy fiction is the nature of what it means to be a spy and to live a double life and to live in secrecy and to interact with the world on multiple levels at once and what that means for emotional life and drama, right? So I too am interested in where the story is set, but my hope is that I'm not going to start Googling, you know, MI5, MI6, 2010 to see if like the targets.
No, I wasn't. Yeah, I wasn't really thinking. I was just thinking about it more in terms of the various iterations of the way we've kind of like thought about espionage and everything else. But there is something in the story itself, which is about a group of disgraced spies being thrust into a case that could bring them salvation or total destruction. That is like, just sign me up. That just sounds like a great idea. So I'm really excited to check that out. We can get into Top Chef. I was just going to ask you one question.
Yeah.
So right before we started recording, there was a story on Deadline about Phoebe Waller-Bridge getting to basically ramping up production on her new show, her first, like, a show I think that will be truly hers in a sense that Run wasn't or whatever, like, you know, that is like
or
her
Killing Eve.
True follow-up. Yeah, or Killing Eve wasn't, because she turned over Killing Eve after the first season. And that it was, you know, basically like she'd had this overall deal with Amazon for a couple of years now and very excited. Any Phoebe Waller-Bridge stuff would be incredible. She had done some rewriting work on the James Bond movie. She's doing, she's going to be appearing in the next Indiana Jones film. But I was curious, how does it work when somebody has like an overall at Amazon like that? But are they're working on stuff for AMC, stuff for HBO? They're out there doing rewrite work on MGM movies or whatever, you know?
First of all, I know nothing about the nature of her deal or what she has been working on, the project she has brought in, where they are at in terms of development. Like, we could have... A deadline story is significant in terms of where a project is or where the studio behind it wants to position it in terms of the marketplace and the larger general public. But it often tells you absolutely nothing about timeline. You know, like this week, the trades had the story about our friend of the pod, Sam Esmail, making Metropolis for Apple. Mm-hmm. This is the project that I worked on in fall of 2016. You know, like this is not news. I think, you know, he's prepping it. Like, this was already all in the works, but now it was ready to be announced because maybe the deals were closed or whatever. It's also not reflective of, you know, she may have six things stalled at different parts, at different places on the course. You know what I mean? Like, not ready to be announced, but maybe they're waiting on a director or maybe a network, or not a network, it's all Amazon. But basically, we don't know how productive she's been vis-a-vis this deal. But I will say that deals are tricky things because It's not unlike, you know, it's not unlike in professional sports where, you know, the most valued years in a way from a management perspective are when people are young and hungry and under rookie deals. And then They are kind of, they get in the giant deals that they then sign afterwards. Some of that you almost have to consider as thank you money for what you did when you were underpaid, right? You become Overpaid for it.
The Kobe Bryant thank you tour.
Exactly. So for Phoebe, the other thing that comes into play is position. So when she was not exclusive to Amazon, she may have sold a show like to HBO or a show somewhere else. And if those deals predate the overall, they are in a first position or second position. And she can work on them even though she is under an overall for everything else going forward from the date of signing it. So, gotcha. And then the third piece is it's a TV deal. So if she wants to go act in a movie or rewrite a movie or write a movie, not relevant. She can go do that and do that work and sell it wherever she wants. So it's risky for, not risky for the richest company in the world like Amazon, but it can be risky for some of the smaller networks or streamers to make mega deals because you can't actually guarantee the return you're getting. And very few of them, dollar for dollar, earn out. All of this is to say, I did note that same thing that you did, which was everybody in the world wants a new Phoebe Waller-Bridge show that she's writing and starring in, you know, that she's doing the Fleabag treatment on. It's legitimately exciting. And it was noteworthy in that deal. They were like, she signed a 3-year deal with Amazon in 2019. So the timing
we're coming up on the end of it.
Timing looks good for her. It seems smart. But the main takeaway, business stuff aside, is this is great. Let's get a new Phoebe Waller-Bridge show. And it's not going to be, for people who don't follow the trades the way we do, briefly was maybe looking like it was going to be a Mr. and Mrs. Smith reimagined.
Yeah, that was like a Donald Glover thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah, who also now has a massive overall at Amazon. But it is not going to be that. It's going to be something original to her.
Okay. Well, let's get into Top Chef. So for this first episode, you know, last season we did recaps of every episode pretty extensively, dedicated our second episode of The Watch per week to it. At least for this
people
one,
loved
I think.
It. People loved that, I think.
No notes. I think that for this one, at least we can kind of keep this conversation somewhat brief. I'm so excited to have Top Chef back, as I'm sure you are. This was a beef-heavy episode, I suppose, as it's a Texas set episode. Although they took great pains to talk about like the melting pot that is Houston and how many different cuisines are in it. But I feel like they prepared steak. There was a lot of steak being prepared in this episode, right?
A great amount of steak, yeah.
And I don't actually find steak that interesting to watch.
No. No, let alone, can you imagine sitting down for essentially a 15-course beef tasting menu?
Yeah. That was like when you go through your fourth tartare, I'm like, wow, you really committed to this. You know, we talked a lot last season about the beauty of a kinder, gentler Top Chef and whether or not it removed some of the inherent drama to the show. And you know, I noted that for the most part, the chefs got along in this first episode. There was nobody who was like, I'm not here to make friends. They all seem like largely delightful people, at least so far.
Two people were like, I'm not here to make beef dishes, apparently.
That's
one
right.
Of them went home, one of them went home for it.
I mean, honestly, like, if I had a theme of this episode, it would be like human frailty and vulnerability in the endemic or late pandemic era was kind of the main idea of this debut episode.
Yeah, it was wild to hear a chef be like, so, you know, just between us, just really on the tail end of a vid infection and I can't smell or taste anything.
Right.
That was wild.
That was Jackson, and, I believe, right?
Yes, who otherwise...
It's kind of hard to remember the names for everybody, yeah.
Pretty well. And then there was Leah, who was suffering from a bladder infection at a really yes. terrible time and clearly was thrown off of her game as... You know, we're spoiling the show, right? Like people... We've watched the episode, so we're talking
Yeah, this will go episode. Up after the episode. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so she went home. So... Everyone listening to this podcast knows this. I've seen all this. I've watched all now 19 seasons of this show. First episodes are always messy, just simply too many people. It is a credit, as it always is, to Magical Elves, the production company, that they can make anything coherent out of this mm-hmm. many new people doing things. That said, I found this to be a pretty dispiriting premiere. Not because of the cast per se, because as I've been alluding to, like, we don't know personalities yet. You come out of this, you know, like this episode, like you do many seasons, being like, oh, Joe seems interesting and like a fun person to hang around. That guy, what Buddha, what's his story? Or Darnell, right. I'd like to hang out with him. Like, okay, so there's some people who clearly have talent.
Stephanie doesn't seem to
view.
Like Asian food. Yeah.
Like, there is also, what's amazing is that for men, you know, for like half a decade, the villain was, you know, villain is used very much in quotes, but was just like the kind of bro-y, doughy, white American chef.
Hyper-competitive, yeah, Voltaggio.
Who won the first seasons. But in the last few years, that person has been kind of set up by the cameras and the editing to be kind of a villain. There was Gabriel, not the one who won, Gabe, who didn't win last year, who was kind of set up that way. And he seemed to be ultimately fine, just like a fine person, potentially unlike the season winner.
Right.
The late or contemporary period Top Chef villain is the clueless Midwesterner. You know, do you remember the woman last year was just like, I'm just here to make spetzel. And I was like, oh, honey, you picked the wrong room, you know? and this lady who's from North Dakota, who's just like,
she's from Bismarck. Yeah.
She was like, they wanted Asian food. So I made steak and potatoes with bok choy that I passively aggressively forgot. And the best part is Kristen Kish is like, was the bok choy Asian? And she was like, I kind of spritzed a lime near it, which is like the way alcoholics like vermouth in their martinis, you know, just like That's wave right. the bottle at the other end of the room. So the characters are the characters, but what kind of bummed me out was two things. The real strength and joy of the last two seasons, you know, and maybe these are cumulative feelings that one acquires after watching so much Top Chef. They weren't necessarily the competition, although both of the last two seasons finished so wildly strong with just fantastic competition. So I don't want to discount that enormous piece of the show, which is a reality competition series. But a sense of place and a sense of community have become equal partners, I think, in the Top Chef experience. And I felt like both were really, really lacking here. The sense of place surprised me because not only was this the first post-quarantine season of Top Chef, they filmed it in Texas, which from my understanding never had a pre or during quarantine period of COVID.
Right.
And so I was really surprised that for the first episode, and maybe I'd love to hear about this, maybe they were actually still under kind of bubble protocols and running a, you know, and they had to be under COVID protocols just as a Hollywood
production.
Yeah,
I mean, they were wearing their masks in Whole Foods and everything like that.
Yeah, no one else was. Everyone else was like Ron DeSantis being like, please stop this theater. And they're like, literally, sir, this is a theatrical production for television.
This guy has COVID.
This guy has active COVID right now. He cannot smell you coming near. The lip service paid to Houston was prevalent. But you and I, you know, the official mascot of this show is not Christine Baranski. It's the Houston episode of Parts Unknown. I mean, we both are obsessed with Houston's culinary scene and would love to spend time visiting it. I was really shocked that the first episode wasn't a here's why we're here primer. Like, we are absolutely going to a place where within steps of each other, you can get the best banh mi of your life and brisket and taco. You know what I mean? Like, let's show us why we're here and really like get into it. And in fact, it went the opposite direction. It felt bubbly in that the first challenge was another kind of like overly busy. You can't talk to each other, so we can't actually communicate, bit of gamesmanship, and then a whole lot of steak. And then the sense of community part for me was that was disappointing was, you know, I loved the judge panel. I loved having our pals back. I loved what that did for the consistency week to week and the people's ability to watch chefs grow. Clearly, they remember that. I mean, these people are really smart who make this show. They adapt and they pay attention to what works and what doesn't. And so as we learned, someone from the past is going to be back every week. And this week it was one of our favorites, Dawn, although you and I both cringe whenever she says Houston is her city because we know she's from Philly. We know.
Right.
We claim her. We want her as one of ours. So that's going to be a part of it. But then when you got to the
I feel like Houston
judgment,
and Philadelphia now have a much more like equitable talent exchange right now, you know?
On the court? You mean?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I was stunned by the level of chefs that were and cooks that were at the table for judgment. Like Chris Shepherd was just like lurking in the corner like the Incredible Hulk. And like he's one of the most prominent and powerful restaurateurs in Houston. And he got like three lines to be like, that was good. You know?
Yeah.
I just thought that was there's not enough real estate for all of this. But it felt like a episode of Top Chef from any year in the last decade when I have been so enjoying the show's evolution and reaction to events of the world, both social and cultural, but then also viral in the way that it pivoted and made a great season last year somehow. So I was left feeling as cold as the tartar.
Speaking of tartar, a couple of people did distinguish themselves, I thought, in this episode.
Yeah.
So I thought it was noteworthy that when everybody does the introductions and they're like, has anybody here, you know, been nominated for a James Beard Award and worked in Michelin star restaurant? And then there's like the one guy who worked at Noma, right?
Yeah.
Now, all these people have like incredible CVs, so I'm not trying to dis-, but I do think that watching the face of Top Chef change over the last 10 years has been really cool. Or I haven't been watching it for 10 years, but watching the last, you know, however many seasons I've watched in the last couple of years. And there's an obvious like shift in the demographic of chef and also the kind of food that they're cooking. So that was notable. I thought that just like, you know, you've got like one or two fine dining, or not even one or two fine dining people, but just like the guy being like, I'm from Noma, and it's like, you're the odd one out here, you know, I thought it was interesting.
And the, you know, this isn't, the edit didn't do this. This is what happened in the episode. The most distinguished, I guess, on paper chef who spent time at Noma totally fucks up the quick fire and doesn't get food on the plate. And then and this is just, you know, back of the
and ironically had Dawn
scratching,
lecturing him on time management.
An incredible moment. Like that was an incredible flex by Dawn. It's like James Hardy telling Tyrese Maxey to get sleep, you know, like sleep is the most important thing to do when you're off the court. The winner, who was, again, the winner, this wasn't like they don't
Robert
things
right?
up, but Robert wins. And I think just back of the notepad scratching is like Robert seemed like the least credentialed chef. Like
well,
his
he
whole thing was that I've
been
a,
in a restaurant since 2019.
He was a private chef. And moved very slowly in the kitchen and somehow won for beef that I kind of wish they would explain these things a little bit more. Like the last time we saw his beef, he was like kind of poking at it with some sort of wire sieve, being like, this is too tough to be served. And then everyone was like, this beef was perfect.
Right.
How does that happen?
Anybody, so it's hard to like say like this person's food jumped out at me, but I did think Ashley was really interesting. So Ashley is a chef from Virginia Beach who is trained in French cuisine and Italian cuisine, but cooks Southern Appalachian cuisine. And she was featured like in the photos of her when she was introducing herself, like she's like working on a farm and is doing a lot of like sourced, like locally sourced dishes. She did a really interesting tartare, I thought, that seemed to really grab the judge's attention. And I just, vibe-wise, really was into Joe.
Joe had the best vibes.
Yeah.
Without question.
So yeah, it'll be, you know, it's really hard to say. Like, I don't think Robert is in any way like the leader in the clubhouse just because he won one event. And I feel bad for the lady who went home, who was obviously not feeling well, but seemed almost to be like, I volunteer as tribute. Like I had a bad day.
And there were other people like Monique has, I've heard about her restaurant in San Francisco. She seemed really focused and her plating was really good, but there definitely wasn't. And I'd like to go back. I kind of wonder if you watch past seasons and first episodes, it has happened, but I don't think it's happened often that like someone just comes out on the gate on fire and is just so clearly outclassing everyone else. But I guess I kind of wished someone had, because I kind of wanted someone to separate from the pack and be like, oh, we're throwing down a gauntlet that we're going to be able to do this
you
season.
Can kind of start to just see heavyweights come out. Like Shota, I thought like was pretty hot out of the gate and didn't quite lead wire to wire and obviously didn't, you know, win. But like, I thought you can sometimes see people kind of distinguish themselves early on.
The other thing that was kind of lacking, other than I think you're right to shout out Ashley, was at least in the early going, or at least in the people who got showcased, the thing about Shota that was so remarkable was Shota just was literally cooking in a different language than everybody else. You know, the techniques that he learned in Japanese kitchens just set him apart. And they didn't necessarily make him better than everyone else, although he's so exceptional, they kind of did. He was just clearly making food from a very different approach than other people's, which, you know, there was a very diverse cast last year, but it did, by and large, come from a Western cooking, slicing, and plating perspective. And that was cool to have that other energy in the kitchen. And I would imagine there are people that I'm forgetting or overlooking or didn't get screen time that will bring that this season. But that was something that I was really appreciating about the show in the past. I don't know. I think it's a different energy.
You want them to get outside. You want them to go around Houston. You want them to get some pho. You know,
I do, and then
get in the cut.
You had all those like heavy hitters at the table. And then the guy who was at judge's table at the end was the guy who hosted them, who may well be an important restaurateur in Houston, and that maybe is an essential restaurant, but he didn't feel like a heavyweight to me because I didn't know him, and also because I kind of like, this is weird to say, but at this point in the show's history, the insular nature of it isn't a bad thing. Like, I wanted Dawn there. Like, Dawn has been there. Dawn lives in Houston. So Dawn being like, this is why you won, for me would have been better television and maybe even had more credibility because she knows what the show can be capable of.
Is Tom still tweeting about crypto?
I mean, as you know, that was a trap. As you know, I've not been on Twitter since December. But one of the things that pushed me off, other than just general, like people, I'm not an epidemiologist, but here's why you're effed. One of the things that got me off of Twitter was Tom being like, wink emoji, here's a burger NFT, get familiar. And I was like, you're better than this, Tom.
Tom Colicchio, 5 hours ago, we're live on Twitter Spaces. Come ask some questions about food, music, Web3, and tonight's Top Chef premiere. So yes, he's still tweeting about crypto.
People get brain broken, man, huh? Like, what is that?
Can I eat Kraft in the metaverse? Like, I don't think so, right?
I don't think so. I mean, I guess he was kind of at the forefront of just like, the chef throwing up your hands and being like Kramer doing the movie phone imitation and saying, why don't you just tell me what you want to eat? Because the innovation at Kraft, people don't know this, the innovation at his big restaurant Kraft was that the menu is divided between like mains and sides. And you could be like, yes, I think that I, a customer who has never sat in a restaurant this fancy before, should be the one to decide what the steak goes well with.
Like, right.
Power to the people, man. I guess it's all, you know, wide open systems. That's what the future. It's blue sky, right? That's what Twitter's getting into.
That's
so.
Right. We could tap out there. We'll keep talking about Top Chef throughout this season. I think as the early episodes go on, like it's easier to kind of fit them into our Thursday shows rather than dedicating 45 minutes to them. We'll get into my interview with Nikolai Coster-Waldau from the film Against the Ice, as well as obviously Game of Thrones on Monday. We're going to have a special guest, Adam Scott from Severance is joining us. And we'll be talking a little bit about the first few episodes of Severance and his career. It's a really cool long talk, but we'll also chat maybe a little bit about The Dropout and some other stuff. And I think we have another guest on the following Thursday. So we have a ton of guests right now. Yeah, we do. We're cooking.
We're being very welcoming to people.
That's right. We are.
Space.
It's a big tent. We were produced by Kaya McMullen. As always, Andy, I'll talk to you on Monday.
I can't wait.
Nikolai, I wanted to start obviously talking about Against the Ice, but I've been really like intently following your career. I know most people would say Thrones, but I obviously was a fan of that. But like, I got to see Small Crimes a few years ago at South By, and it really stood out to me. I loved that movie. I felt like you loved that movie and love movies like that. And I was wondering if, in relation to Against the Ice and the stuff you've been doing over the last couple of years, if that was a little bit of a turning point for you of, hey, I'm going to start making like maybe some smaller stuff, but stuff that I feel really personally invested in. And if that led to Against the Ice in some ways.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've always loved those movies. I mean, those character-driven dramas, well, comedies, whatever it is. And Game of Thrones is the anomaly. I didn't know it was going to last for 10 years.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a wonderful gift, and I'm forever grateful for it. But I've been doing those movies always since the beginning of since I started. And then I've been, doing some big budget Hollywood, movies. I've tried that, and it's great. I like acting. I like to dive into characters. I like to get to portray people that are resembles people I know, like with all the, whatever that includes as a human being. And the fact that we are so full of contradictions, that we are not just one thing or two things, but we are many things, right?
Yeah.
I think that can be things that are sometimes lost in the big, big budget action movies, for example. It's like there's just not room for that kind of character, to explore characters like that, which I get. And then, you shouldn't, because then you would get boring. It would get boring because you want to get to the next car chase. But yeah, so you're right in your observation, but I for me, it's never stopped.
I guess this goes back all the way to Wildside, right? Because that's, you co-wrote that, right? And I got to see a little bit of bits and pieces of that. I couldn't find it like just to like rent and watch, but that looked like a really cool movie. It looked like you and Mads looked like
it was a very, I was young, and it was me and my friend Mads Mikkelsen, Danish actor as well. There are similarities in some, to Against the Ice, and I never thought of it until after. But my character in Wildside is called Oscar Mikkelsen.
Yeah.
And we shot it in Iceland, and it's very much a story about friendship. Against the Ice, we shot in Iceland and in Greenland. My character name is Mikkelsen, and it's very much a story about companionship and friendship. So there's a theme there that I apparently like to explore.
Is the writing bug something that you've never kind of gone away from? Have you been kind of working on stuff throughout your career, or is this a particular project that you wanted to get your hands dirty with?
I've been writing since then. I there was a break after Wildside. Me and the director had another project we were working on, and then that fell through. And then I just started working a lot as an actor. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't until like, I guess, 10, 12 years ago with me and Joe Derek, my co-writer here, we've been friends forever. And he started telling me these stories that he was experiencing. And I know that he can write. I knew he could write. He was a musician. He wrote these beautiful lyrics. And I said, all these stories you're telling me, I think there's something there. Maybe we could write together. I didn't know if we could. And then we just started, and we've been developing these various stories, a couple of plays and movies. And now, this is the first one that has been made, but we have a lot of stories on the shelves. So to answer your question, I have been writing quite a bit, and I love it. I love it. It's a different way of telling stories. And I obviously I am drawn to, I can see that my day job affects my writing. Like with this story, it's the characters, it's the surprises in characters that I'm attracted to.
I was wondering whether or not like you could even define the different muscle you get to exercise in writing versus performing. And I was curious also, as somebody writes, like it can be very frustrating. It could be very lonely. It can be very like confounding sometimes. Like if you experienced.
For me, I think that in the beginning of, watching for so many years, Dan Weiss and David Benioff work on Game of Thrones. And that's like looking at them and they're going, I was talking to Joe about it. Like, listen, two best, go to work every day with your best friend. And I mean, that sounds like heaven to me. So yeah, that's why we then started our company 2 years ago too, because I was like, I'm going to be inspired by that. Because it is, I think that is my biggest challenge as when I'm writing, is to the discipline on just not running away from the work. I mean, not to find excuses for not doing the work. It is brutal. It's great when you have the moments of inspiration, but sometimes you have to find that. It's not just going to happen. And then you have someone that is to have someone to do it with. For me, it really helps.
So for Against the Ice, which in some ways is this epic, sweeping, very physical movie, but in another way is almost like black box theater, because it's really you and Joe just kind of in this blank canvas landscape in a lot of ways. Yeah. What were some of the things that you were trying to do, maybe structurally, maybe I'm very curious about the writing process for this in particular, because it's at once like an adventure movie, but it's at once a very, very intimate character study.
Yeah. I think, yes, it is. And obviously it's based on, it's a true story. It's based also on this book, Two Against the Ice, that Ina Mikkelsen wrote. And it was what I, cause I love, I mean, you know, story, the whole, all these stories of explorers, you know, I've heard them from I was a kid, and I always find it exciting. Like that whole idea of finding unknown land and going to places where no one's been, there's something, you know, very, you know, interesting about it. It's exciting. But then there's also a lot of movies like that, and it can get, you know, you can tell the story quickly and then you go, well, what else is there? But what I loved about this book was the way he described the inner life, how it affects the mentally, how your brain will make up stuff that isn't there. And then because that's all we have, our perception, this is, everything is subjective, you know, reality is really just what is constructed in here, right? Like the two realities you and I have now is so different. You know, we're talking to each other, but I'm in a room, there's some people sitting there with computers. I'm like, you know, and you're sitting somewhere else. And I mean, we believe that we are we are communicating and we're in the same world, but still at the same time, our realities are very different. Anyway, I'm being very theoretical here, but there's something about that I just find interesting. And I love that the way they describe, he describes in the book, how they see things, how, even when they know that this is cannot be real, they want to explore it. They want they see food, like the old cartoon story.
Yeah.
Like they see food. Ivor sees his grandfather, and in the story we have that in the film, but in the real story they spend days looking for him, even though they knew he wasn't there because there was no way he could be there. And then of course there's this little part of the book which talks about this postcard, and the way he described that was very moving, and I thought was interesting that they find a postcard with these women on, you know, just all these women lined up in front of a house, and Ivor picks three and Ina picks one to be their girlfriends, and then these girlfriends become very real, especially for Mikkelsen. So the fact that, like, we found these recordings of the guys when they were old, and it's moving here. Like, I think Mikkelsen was 89 and Ivor was 85 at the time. And they're talking about this, and you remember when we saw your grandfather? Oh, we were so silly. We were like losing our minds. So funny. And then we did this, and then we did that, and you found that postcard. And we had the girlfriends, and then suddenly Mikkelsen gets serious and goes, and that was the time you let me down. That was the one time when my friend let me down. And the fact that the reality is that these were imaginary women. And Ivor just made a comment saying, yeah, I had a dream about your girlfriend. I'm sorry. Clearly, this wasn't real. But 40 years after, 50 years, after the fact, the emotional response was still so strong that Mikkelsen still had to say, "You let me down."
Yeah, he's still holding on to it. Yeah.
It's still raw. And I thought that was just a beautiful thing. And I thought that was interesting to write about. And then the fact that with most explorers, you don't just go out there, you choose. These are people that are driven. They want to go and conquer the world. They're alpha males. They have something to prove. And in this particular story, yeah, we have one of them who is all that. The other guy is nothing like that. He just happened to be there. And then he has like so much admiration for the other guy that when the captain Mikkelsen asks for a volunteer, he just goes, "Oh, all right. Yeah, no, I'm a mechanic and yeah. It's kind of boring being here stuck in the ice. So I'll do that," because he has complete trust and faith in this guy's abilities. And the fact that you have two so different characters, you know, as you say, it's almost like a little chamber piece caught up in this epic landscape, I thought was really interesting. And the fact that our story has like the tension of the first half is about this crazy survival, and the second half is also about survival, but it's maybe in many ways more of a mental.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. At least that was the ambition we had.
I thought it was structurally really interesting that way. You know what I mean? Because I think that there are points you're sort of trained watching survival movies or against nature movies, and you're like, yeah, this is the part when they do this, and this is the part when they get rescued, or this is the part when they think they're not going to get rescued. Yeah, and then it just becomes a much more of a psychological battle. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Mikkelsen character, because, you know, you've played great characters, you've done Macbeth, you've played, you know, sort of like there are characters that are larger than life, and then you're bringing this character to life, and I obviously saw shades of, like, you know, Captain Ahab-esque behavior occasionally in Mikkelsen. I was curious about juggling, you know, you have these recordings, you have this book, you have like the real person, and then you have sort of obviously the dramatic impulse and the desire to create like an interesting character and playing with archetypes like that, because he's not all Ahab, you know, he doesn't lose it out there and, you know, in a way that, like, where it's far beyond driven, but he is driven by something greater than purely survival. I mean, he wants to get these journals. He wants people to know the truth about Greenland. So if I was curious about the sort of the real man versus the character that we see on screen, and how you thought about that.
Well, what we found out when I was starting doing research was that right after the trip, he wrote one book. Mm-hmm. And in that book, he doesn't mention Ivar that much. It's really his accomplishment. The second book, Two Against the Ice, is dedicated to Ivar. And he clearly states that the reason I'm alive is because of this man. I owe him everything. And I thought that was interesting. We want to have that into our story. So in our story, we also make him older. In the reality, he was 29 when he did this. In our story, he's my age. And so there is that age gap between the two characters. We have his second in command at one point said early on, says, "What are you doing? You don't have anything to prove. Like, you're an old man. You're getting old. You're too old." And he's like, "What are you talking about? Like, this is insane." So he has the arrogance and the self-belief and all that stuff, all the things that, like, a guy who has something to prove, right? And driven by honor and, you know, all those things. Then he has a journey. He has to learn something. And it's these very basic human things, is that we are only something because of the people we surround ourselves with, mm-hmm. people we get into contact with, for better or for worse. That's what defines us. We're nothing on our own. He believes that, you know, the expeditions Mikkelsen had done before this were all solo. He was a guy who was like, you know, "I know best. I don't need anyone else." But he finds out the hard way that you do. And I thought, you know, wanting to do that is kind of a whole life of him. Like, we wanted to, that, you know, to get into this story like that would, which in reality took him probably 20 years to come to that conclusion. We wanted to do that in this story, but you're right. He was a real guy. He's loved by his family. He's a hero in the family. We were very conscious of that responsibility. And I knew that, of course, we are, this is kind of spoiled, but he loses his mind a little bit in this movie. I mean, and of course, that is something that we, you know, make up based on the book, but he doesn't go into these details. He's just saying, we knew we were losing our minds, but we had to, you know, he's trying to be, what do you call it, sensible about it. He doesn't go into, when he writes, it's not an emotional thing. He says, the most he can say, yes, we came back and noticed that there had been someone here to come rescue us and we missed them. That was a tough day.
It's a stiff upper lip. That's pretty good.
But then we had a screening for the family and I spent a lot of time talking to his great-great-granddaughter. Her name is Naya Mikkelsen, after Naya in the movie. And I mean, they were so happy. They were so proud of the movie. I was so relieved. They felt that we honored their relative in a good way. And they felt that all the stuff that we did, even when we showed him in a not the best of lights, they got it. They understood it. And then the respect. So that was a relief. But we also did think a lot about it. Wanted it to be truthful. Didn't want to make it. I mean, you could have made this. You could have done a lot with this story. You could have, gone complete horror, terror, thriller. The cannibalism. You could have gone that way. But we just felt there was so much humanity in it that for us was more interesting. Like that, the emotional impact of this thing between these two men. The pain of longing, the pain of loss, that idea that we all know that if we're away from home, if we have families, you can miss someone. To then know that maybe everyone back home believes I no longer exist.
Right.
How does that affect you? That all these things we wanted to explore. And I think I'm really happy with the way it turned out.
You know, and I don't want to keep it too long, but one of the things that's sort of been a hallmark of the last 10, 12 years or so of your work, and, I was thinking about Shot Caller and, some of the more recent films you've done is like you really seem to gravitate towards characters placed in moments of extremity, even Taste of Hunger. I think that being a chef in and of itself is kind of like, extreme profession. How hard is it, or maybe now that you're older, it's easier. How hard is it to shake these roles after you're done?
Well, I mean, it's not. I think about it all the time. It's on my mind all the time. My next movie that comes out, I think, is called God is a Bullet that I did with Nick Cassavetes. When we talk about that, I have some stories to tell. But usually, it's not hard at all. It's not hard at all. I have my sanity. I can still, see. It's a job, and there's a lot of things that go into it. But it is a job that I'm able to let go of, I think.
Do you think that having more responsibilities in different parts of Against the Ice allowed you to kind of compartmentalize that way? Because, you're also...
I think that I've always had that interest, even when I'm not producing as here or writing, that I've always had that interest in the actual construction of the story, that I'm part of it. And we're telling a story together. We all have our parts to play. I've never, ever felt that I was like an isolated part of it that I didn't care about the rest. So I think that's also why I'm doing it now, why I'm writing and I'm producing, because I've always had that interest. I don't know. I mean, I it's a difficult thing to add. I mean, I think if you ask my wife, she'll tell you that no, he stays in character all the time. I don't know.
Nikolai, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, man.
Take care.
Take care. You too.